Ladies and gentlemen, last time we were discussing the problem of who am I, and discussing it in terms of the answers which had been given in the past, the answer given by Homer, the answer given by the Old Testament writers, and to some slight extent the answer given in more recent times in Europe. Today I want to continue this question and to start giving an answer in contemporary terms. It'll take more than one lecture, I think, to attempt an answer to this extremely difficult problem of who we are. Let us begin with the notion of I. The I, the ego, remains very much what it was in Homer's time. That is to say, the self-conscious being who uses verbal symbols, who is able to employ his reason, who looks before and after. And this I has been defined in its essential form by Descartes as the creature who thinks, the cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And more recently, beginning with Maine de Biron in the 18th century and going on with Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, and more recently with Bergson, William James, and Dewey, the I has been defined as the creature who wills, that instead of cogito ergo sum, the phrase should be volo ergo sum, I will, therefore I am. And in fact, I would say that the I, the self-conscious being, is the creature who wills and who thinks. Now, this creature finds itself habitually confronted by what Maine de Biron called organic resistances. In a word, the I finds itself surrounded by a number of not-I's. Within its own organism, it is only one among a considerable number of very important and dynamic factors. Well, as we saw in the old times, these not-I's were spoken of largely in either in physiological or in supernatural terms. We have the idea in Homer of the not-I's, which are represented by the thumos, this energy of passion in the chest, the phrein, this mental and also emotional aspect of the midriff, the reins in the biblical language, the bowels at the same time in the biblical language, the heart, and so on, plus these various forces of a semi, more or less completely supernatural kind, the arte, the supernatural force which makes us do things against our own interests, and the menos, in Homer's words, which is the same thing as the spirit of God which came upon Samson, this accession of power from outside the I, which permits the I to do things which otherwise it would find completely impossible. Well, these, as I say, were the terms used in the past for describing these non-personal elements of our being with which the I has willy-nilly to live and which it has to get on with as best it may. Let us now start thinking of these not-I's within the total organism in contemporary terms. And we will begin on the physical level, the level of the body, because this is quite clearly the basic level on which the unconscious, this idea which is so extremely important in modern psychology, this is the basic level on which the unconscious functions. At its deepest level, the unconscious is the body, that we are dictated to by this strange intelligence within our physical organism, which carries on and does extraordinary things without our knowing how we do it, how these things are done. The most obvious example of what the body can do apart from the eye is illustrated by what happens when we give a command. Say, I will that my hand shall go up into the air. Well, I will it all right, but I haven't the faintest idea how this act is performed. I say, I wish it to go up. And actually, as we've discovered as a result of very long and arduous research, the processes involved in lifting my hand are incredibly complex, and we have, as an I, a self-conscious being, we have absolutely no idea of what these processes are. We merely give this command, and we leave it to somebody else to carry it out. And this somebody else works in an almost infallible way, if we leave him alone, to carry on the main processes of our bodily existence. It looks after the heartbeat, it looks after our digestion, it looks after respiration, it looks after glandular secretions, it looks after the healing process. All these things go on without the eye being in any way able to help them. All that we really know is that the eye can get in the way of these things going on. That, in fact, what are called psychosomatic diseases are the consequences of the eye and the personal unconscious interfering with the otherwise almost infallible proceedings of this deeper self within us. Well, now, what on earth is this deeper self on the physiological level? We have no really satisfactory name for it in the present. In the past, we had some names. For example, in the Aristotelian psychology and physiology, there was the mention of a kind of trinity of souls. There was the rational soul, which was the soul belonging to the eye, but there were also the vegetative and the animal souls, which looked after the physiological processes in the body. And we have to, I think, to think in these terms. We have to think of this strange kind of physiological intelligence which is looking after us without our knowing how on earth it does its work, and which, as I say, we can't help, but which we can interfere with. And this physiological intelligence is most extraordinary. We can observe it, for example, in certain animals. There is, of course, the intelligence of the instincts, which are extraordinary enough, which have been developed by evolution over the course of millions of years. But over and above these instinctive, purposive actions, there are actions carried out by the not I, the vegetative soul, shall we say, the entelechy, whatever you like to call it, which are ad hoc actions, which are not instinctive at all, and which yet betray the most extraordinary degree of intelligence and purpose. Perhaps the most, one of the most fantastic examples of this kind of ad hoc physiological intelligence is the ability, for example, of the parrot to imitate a human voice. It's very interesting to analyze what goes on in this very strange process. The parrot presumably listens to the human voice, is conscious, insofar as parrots are conscious, and I suppose they are conscious, listens to what is being said, takes some kind of interest in what is being said, wishes, for reasons heaven only knows why, to reproduce what is being said. And then something else takes over, this kind of physiological intelligence within the parrot, which is infinitely more intelligent than the parrot itself, takes over and proceeds to manipulate literally hundreds of muscles in the parrot's speaking apparatus. And remember that the parrot's speaking apparatus, noise-making apparatus, is utterly different from the human noise-making apparatus. It has no teeth, no soft palate. Its tongue is perfectly different from ours. It has a beak. Its vocal cords are different. But with this perfectly different kind of noise-making machine, it is able to reproduce articulate human speech so well that sometimes other human beings are actually deceived by it. And very often, as we see with parrots with this curious sense of humor, will annoy dogs by imitating their masters and calling them. The more one thinks of this extraordinary performance, the odder it becomes, because it has nothing to do with instinct, it has nothing to do with biological survival. This has never happened before in the course of the development of parrots. But parrots, for an unknown reason, desire to imitate, and their physiological intelligence is able to perform this quite extraordinary act of arranging the muscles to reproduce the sounds it hears with a precision which no merely conscious mind could possibly equal. And something similar, of course, occurs in very small infants. I mean, the fact that infants at a very early age will smile back at a smiling face. I mean, this again is an imitative process. They see the smile, and then there is something within them which proceeds to arrange the muscles of the face in such a way that the smile is reproduced. So that we see that over and above the merely vegetative faculties, the power of keeping the heart beating and the respiration going and the digestion going, the physiological intelligence is capable of very remarkable ad hoc performances. And of course, in our conscious life, this is happening all the time. I mean, we give the orders that we want to do something, we visualize something we want to do, and this thing is done, but not by the eye, but by someone else, by this extraordinary thing we carry about inside us, which is responsible, as I say, not only for the homeostasis of the bodily activities which have to go on all the time, but for these specific ad hoc performances. Well, this is one of the basic physiological facts with which the eye is associated, one of the powers, the not eyes, with which it has to live, and with which it can unfortunately interfere and so create all kinds of distressing psychosomatic diseases. Well, then we have the question of of morphology, the actual shape and structure of the body. What influences do these have upon our psychological life? And here, obviously, the most remarkable fact about human beings, when you look at them in the mass, is that they are very different from one another. And this, of course, illustrates a general evolutionary tendency that the higher up in the scale of evolution a species is, the more profound are the variations within it. And the most highly variable species is Homo sapiens, that this creature is immensely variable. Now, it's along with these morphological variations, there are, of course, very remarkable biochemical variations. These have been investigated in recent years, and it has been found that, as well as looking different from the outside, the human beings are very different from the inside, that their biochemical arrangements have remarkably wide variations between one person and another, that it is possible to carry on human life with a very remarkably different biochemical arrangements. And this biochemical variability is one of the things which annoys pharmacologists very much, because unfortunately, different human beings will react in an entirely different way to the same drug, which is very irritating, because it The one desire, naturally, of any scientific person is to have a standardized thing that you can work upon, and the human being is very, very far from standardized. And indeed, it is naturally this tremendous variability within the physical organism, which is at the basis of all our moral ideas about the goodness of democracy and the value of such things as tolerance and living and letting live, so that we must never forget this extreme variability of the human being. Now, it seems pretty obvious on the face of it that creatures which are so extremely different from one another physically are probably different from one another psychologically. It would be very surprising if differences as great as we can observe, hereditary differences as great as we can observe between one individual and another, should not be correlated with very considerable differences in their behavior and in their general psychological setup. And of course, this has been envisaged, this relationship has been envisaged from very early times. And unfortunately, I would think that among many schools of psychology at the present time, it is sadly underestimated, the importance of the hereditary physical differences in the whole study of the human psyche. I want to read a brief passage now from a recent book by Professor Norman Brown called Life Against Death. He is speaking there very critically of the neo-Freudians and blaming them for thinking too much in purely psychological terms about the problems of psychology. And he sets up as against the neo-Freudians the what he calls the materialism of Freud himself. He says, with the loss of the Freudian materialism of the body, psychology becomes, in neo-Freudian hands, as also in Jungian hands, once more what it was before the Freudian revolution, a psychology of the autonomous soul. Well, this is a generalization. But when we pass from this kind of generalization to the specific facts of the case and see what Professor Brown, who is an ardent Freudian, has to say about what he calls the Freudian materialism of the body, we find that the materialism consists almost exclusively in a preoccupation with events only in two parts of the body, the mouth and the anus. Well, actually, we are conscious of being aware of being somewhat more than the two ends of the digestive tube. And it is, I must say, I think an absolutely extraordinary fact to find that what Brown calls the Freudian materialism of the body boils down to this incredibly limited preoccupation with only an infinitesimal part of the total physical organism. After all, we are much more than these two aspects of the body which Freud has been so closely preoccupied with. And we do know that our bodies do have the most profound influence upon our behavior and upon other people's behavior. Well, the realization of the interdependence of mental behavior and of physical structure goes back to great antiquity. It was formulated by Hippocrates, the father of Western medicine, who spoke about two main physical types, what he called the phthisic habitus and the apoplectic habitus. The apoplectic habitus is still, we recognize it very clearly, it's the sort of big, burly, rather fattish, typical businessman or politician who is going to have the renal cardiac syndrome in later life, which Hippocrates recognized very clearly. And this is still a variety of human being we quite clearly recognize. The phthisic syndrome, the phthisic habitus, was a slight mistake, because Hippocrates evidently thought that the opposite of this thin, slender type was particularly subject to phthisis or tuberculosis, and there is no particular evidence to show that it is the case. Well, in fact, the point is that he did distinguish these two types of human being. Well, then we get another approach to the mind-body problem in Aristotle, who had a very curious approach. I mean, he tried to correlate mental characteristics with only one physical characteristic. For example, the shape of the nose he was very interested in, and he was interested in the resemblance of human beings to certain animal types and would classify them in this way, that there were leonine-looking people who were leonine in character, or rather like what we suppose lions to be like, which evidently is not at all what they are like. And there is something in this. I mean, if you look at a photograph of Garibaldi, he looked exactly like a lion, and he was a very leonine man. But this is, of course, a very crude system of correlation. Well, then, with Galen, in the beginning of our era, we get a much more elaborate typology, a correlation between mind and body, in terms of the four humors, blood, black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm. And we still use these words. I mean, this is interesting to see that this very ancient psychophysical theory has left its trace upon our current vocabulary. We still speak about people of a sanguine temperament, a phlegmatic temperament, people who are choleric, people who are melancholic with the preponderance of black bile, and so on. And doctors and physiologists went on speaking in these terms right on into the 18th century, almost into the 19th century, and they were fairly adequate notions. They did help people to think about this fundamental correlation between mind and body. Then in more recent times, in the 19th century, or from the very end of the 18th century and from then on, we get a more scientific approach to the problem. The French were pioneers in this field, and we get a man like Rostand, who speaks of three types of people. He speaks of the type digestif, the type musculaire, and the type cérébral, the digestive, muscular, and cerebral type. Which is an extremely acute observation, that he did distinguish these temperamental differences between these types. Well, then we have, later in the century, we get Viola in Italy talking about, also with a tripartite division into what he called macrosplanchnic, normosplanchnic, and microsplanchnic, which are very much the same as the, when they're explained, as the terms used by Rostand. The short trunk of the long-legged, thin person, the medium trunk of the muscular person, and the heavy, long, relatively long trunk of the bulky person. Then in our own time, we have the studies of Kretschmer, which are very important. And he started with a tripartite division of the athletic, the picnic, and the leptosome, but reduced it, unfortunately, later on to the picnic, the big, fat, bulky type, and the leptosome, the light, thin type. And he made, as I shall point out later on, some very interesting correlations between these types and the different types of insanity. Well, then, more recently, and I would think more scientifically and thoroughly, the matter has been gone into by Dr. W. H. Sheldon and his collaborators, who have developed a powerful technique for analyzing and quantifying the physical differences between human beings in terms of a tripolar frame of reference. He points out that human beings vary continuously in a frame of reference with three poles. And the three poles are what he calls endomorphy, mesomorphy, and ectomorphy. Endomorphy being the pole which at its extreme gives very big, fat, soft people with slow reactions and with a tendency to put on weight and become extremely fat in old age. These people are, in a sense, gut people. They are built around the gut. They have their gut is very often twice as heavy and twice as long as the gut of an extreme ectomorph. And they have this amazing power of assimilation. They are at home in the earth, on the earth, in as much as they have this immense capacity to absorb food and to remain alive. Then the mesomorph are muscle people. They are people with heavy bones and powerful muscles. And you can see their pictures any day in the sporting pages of the newspaper. The professional footballers all belong to this type, this terrific type with its powerful neck. They tend to have a rather coarse skin with the very heavy folds showing in the face. They are extremely strong, they have very great endurance, tremendous driving force, and they are, in their extreme form, the great athletes of the world, and as we shall see when we come to the correlations with temperament, they tend to be the aggressive politicians, businessmen, soldiers, and so on of the world. Then we come to the ectomorphs, who are the thin, light, stringy muscled people, the ratio of whose surface to whose mass is extremely high. They have a very large skin area in relationship to the mass of the body, and consequently their nervous system is much closer to the surface than either the mesomorphs or the endomorphs. And they are, so to speak, built around the nervous system, which is much more vulnerable, being nearer to the outside, and much more sensitive than those of the other two. And Sheldon, as I say, devised a quantifying method for assessing the different amounts of each component in every human being. Every human being has a certain amount of each component, displays a certain amount of each, which can vary on a 7-point scale between 1 and 7. In my own case, for example, I happen to be a 1, 2, 7. Any pattern can be expressed in terms of 3 digits. That is to say, I have a minimum of endomorphy. I have a little mesomorphy, which permits me to get around, and the maximum of ectomorphy. And this is not a very common type. I mean, the types near the middle, naturally, are the commonest. And Sheldon once told me that most members of my type are in asylums, but I'm extremely lucky to be out. another thing which Sheldon stressed as being extremely important in the physical setup was what he calls dysplasia, which is a disharmony between different regions of the body, that a certain region of the body may exhibit a proportion of the three factors, much quite different from other regions. We see this, for example, I mean, this is a typical sort of would-be athlete tragedy. A boy who has enough mesomorphy to feel desire to become an athlete, but unfortunately his extremities have a dysplasia which makes them much more ectomorphic, and he simply doesn't have the strength of arms and wrists and ankles to hold up to his athletic ambitions. He would like to be an athlete, but he just cannot be. And these dysplasias probably play a very important part in juvenile delinquency. And of course, we get another dysplasia, which is very common. I think a great many of them can probably be found in Elizabeth Arden's The Main Chance, of ladies who have a classical torso, but unfortunately, a complete dysplasia in the hips, which tend to bulge out and which cause a great deal of misery, and have to be treated locally with as strenuously as possible. But this again may cause very severe psychological disturbances. And then another factor which Sheldon stresses is what he calls gynandromorphy, that actually all of us display some degree of resemblance to the opposite sex. We have some of the characteristics of the opposite sex, and some may have very little, but some may have a good deal. And of course, again, a high degree of gynandromorphy acts as a kind of total dysplasia and may cause, again, great psychological trouble. Well, then we have to consider, on the basis of these physical differences between individuals, we have to consider what relationship is there between these physical differences and the temperament of the people who have them. Sheldon has been able to establish a fairly high level of correlation between the physical pattern of any given individual and a pattern of temperament, which he measures in terms of the, similarly of a seven-point scale, of the amount of the intensity which is shown in the demonstration of about 60 different fundamental psychological traits, 20 for each, 20 for each of the three components, and he has found that there is, as I say, a very fairly close relationship between the two physical and temperamental patterns. He's found that there may, of course, be a certain amount of deviation, but the deviation is rarely more than 1 point and is sometimes as high as 2 points. But in that case, where the deviation between the temperamental pattern and the physical pattern is as much as 2 points, the person is under very great permanent stress. And deviations of more than 2 points apparently are never found except in mental institutions. And when one asks why there should be deviations, the reason, I presume, is that sociological pressures demand that people should behave in a certain way, which doesn't happen to be the way which their physique would normally ask them to behave. They are practicing what the French philosopher Jules de Gautier called Bovarism. Madame Bovary in Flaubert's novel was a young woman who was continuously trying to behave as though she was somebody that she was not. And Jules de Gautier generalizes this and says that we all have a tendency to try to behave in other as though we were somebody we were not, in conformity with whatever the local, the approved local pattern of behavior in the, our society happens to be. And it is, anthropologists have shown how interesting, how powerful this this trend can be, particularly in primitive societies, which exercise a prodigious pressure upon their members. For example, Margaret Mead showed in her study of the Pueblo Indians that the Pueblos have a profound disapproval of anybody who shows a typical mesomorph behavior. They don't like people who, in our contemporary terms, are aggressive, show leadership, have drive, and so on. They don't want these people. They want people who conform and behave as the other people in the tribe behave. And yet, in spite of this profound sociological pressure, which is going on all the time, it does happen that the internal categorical imperatives of temperament and physique are so strong in certain individuals that they do start trying to behave like Napoleons, with the result that they get severely slapped down by the rest of society. But this shows that, as I say, that even under the greatest sociological pressures, these fundamental physically determined drives of temperament may carry people on into very great social trouble. The moral of that being is that we shouldn't try to mold, squeeze people into the Procrustean bed of our popular conception of human virtue at the moment, but should permit, as far as possible, people to develop along their own temperamental lines. Now, let us give a very brief account of the main temperamental traits connected with the various physical traits, the endomorphy, the mesomorphy, and the ectomorphy. The endomorph, the round, fat, gut people, are distinguished by relaxation, by love of comfort, love of eating, love, above all, of eating in public, love of ceremoniousness. They are very fond of ceremonies. They're good routineers. Then they have a general, universal, indiscriminate amiability. They're very good mixers. They like people. And they are have no difficulty in communication. In fact, they communicate all the time. They are always spilling the beans and telling one what they're feeling at any given moment. They have an extreme extroversion of affect. And under the influence of alcohol, they become even more genial and amiable than they were before. Now, this is very different from the extreme mesomorph, who is a driving person with a love of power, indifference to other people. He tends to be rather callous and trample on other people. He is the typical aggressive go-getter. He may do it very politely, but he is still an aggressive go-getter. He tends to make a great deal of noise. He laughs loudly, he snores loudly, he speaks loudly, and he has all these traits of an effective soldier and politician. Again, if you look at the photographs of politicians, the gentleman who visited our shores recently is quite clearly an endomorphic mesomorph. He has enough endomorphy to be very genial when he wants to be, and to get on with people and to communicate. But this terrific driving force of the mesomorphic temperament, the somatotonic temperament, which goes with mesomorphy. And again, in Vino Veritas, the under alcohol, the somatotonic, high somatotonic person tends to become much more aggressive than he even was ordinarily. And these are the people who get up fights in bars and make themselves very unpleasant and are extremely different from the genial drunks of the on the endomorphic scale. But then we come to the, and here I think we should stress the fact that the mesomorph, both the mesomorph and the endomorph are extremely extroverted, but in totally different ways. And this is, seems to me, a grave mistake in the in Jung's division of people into extroverts and introverts. They exist, but he made no distinction between the two very different forms of extroversion, the extroversion of affect, of telling everybody what one's feeling, and of demanding affection and support from other people, and the extroversion of the mesomorph, which is the extroversion of the person who just drives straight forward, is interested in external things, but not in the least interested in telling people what he's feeling or in getting their sympathy. He walks over them. And these two types of extroversion are very different from one another. Well, then we come to the ectomorph, the cerebrotonic, who is essentially an introvert. He lives in a permanent state of restraint. His actions, his gestures are restrained. He doesn't spill the beans. He feels there's great difficulty in communication. He's not a good mixer. He feels that the endomorph, with his pouring out of well, his feelings, is very shallow and trivial and vulgar in many ways, and he is horrified by the driving energy of the mesomorph. He is very fond of privacy. He doesn't make much noise, and under alcohol, he just feels ill. And doesn't respond at all as the other two respond. Well, there's so much for the picture which we get in what seems to me the most highly developed and scientific correlation yet made between physique and temperament. And it is, I must say, I find it very extraordinary that this should have been so totally neglected by Freudian psychology and by the neo-Freudians too. There's really almost no mention of the body and its influences upon people, except in the very limited way which Freud mentions it, in the literature. For example, one can read case history after case history in these books and never be told who the people are, what they looked like, what their physique was. I mean, we're just told that Mrs. So-and-so came in and such things happened, but we are not told whether Mrs. So-and-so weighed 90 pounds or 200 pounds. And there is, after all, a very considerable difference. I mean, and that it does make an enormous psychological difference of what these people are like. And yet in this, to me, completely incomprehensible style, psychologists proceed as though we were in some way disembodied souls, or souls only with one or other end of a digestive tube, as Freud would have us believe, and nothing else. And it's all the more extraordinary when one reads, for example, in Erich Fromm, who is one of the neo-Freudians, where Fromm talks about temperament. He defines temperament as the psychical qualities which are rooted in a constitutionally given soma. Well, this is an admirable definition. But then he says that this is extremely important that psychologists should take account of these temperamental differences. And he says, oh, undoubtedly in the future this will take place. But he himself pays no further attention to this at all, ignores the fact that there is already a very large literature on the subject and that a great deal could be done already, and he proceeds as though nothing whatever had been done. And this, as I say, I find entirely incomprehensible. All the more so as for the last 2,000 years, much more since the time of Homer indeed, poets and dramatists and narrative writers have realized the extreme importance of the physique in relation to temperament and character. After all, no dramatist or novelist in his senses would put the character of Falstaff in the physique of Cassius, or put the character of Mr. Pickwick in the physique of Scrooge. I mean, everybody has known this for the last 5,000 years, that there were certain things which are totally impossible. And yet, for reasons best known to themselves, this absolutely fundamental fact of everyday experience has very largely been ignored by professional psychologists and psychotherapists, which to me is a most extraordinary thing. And take, for example, a poet I happen to be very fond of, Chaucer. I mean, read the prologue to the Canterbury Tales. You will be amazed at the amount of pure character drawing which comes through simply by a very accurate description of the physique of each of the personages in the poem. It's an extraordinary example of how much can be done with a minimum of psychological analysis, but a maximum of setting forth of the physical differences between people. And we have a very good idea of who these people are simply because there is an admirably vivid description of their outward characteristics. And as I say, the fact that this has been going on for so long does make the neglect of the psychologists, to me anyhow, completely incomprehensible. And now, a very interesting case of the correlation which everybody knows about, between physique and character, is to be found in the traditional image of Christ. Christ has been painted now for nearly 2,000 years. And it is very interesting, if we look at the traditional image of Christ, we find that it always is a personage with a high degree of ectomorphy. On the basis of studying many hundred of these images, Sheldon says that the average figure of Christ in Christian art is a 2-3-5, that is to say, with a certain amount of endomorphy, a bit more of mesomorphy, which gives the endomorphy gives the power of communication, of sympathy, and so on. The mesomorphy gives the messianic drive, the power to carry through the message, and the high degree of ectomorphy gives the inward life, the inward-looking life, and the doctrine of restraint, which has been, after all, it has run through the whole of Orthodox Christianity, this idea of self-control and restraint. And it, of course, it has been one of the great problems of Christianity has been what to do with the extreme mesomorphs. And they have been controlled in various ways by making orders of chivalry and so on to get them into some kind of control. And then there have been elaborate educational procedures, all based upon an ectomorphic view of life, a cerebrotonic view of life, with this idea of restraint and control, which is seen very clearly. I mean, it's quite clear that there's always been an intuition among Christians that this was the inevitable physical form of the Savior, that he must look like this. And that, in fact, it is very interesting, in the rare cases where artists have departed from this traditional norm, we are often rather shocked by the representation. There have been certain artists who have represented the form of Christ, the Christ as a much higher mesomorph. I mean, there's a very famous picture of by Piero della Francesca of the Resurrection, which shows this tremendous athletic figure rising from the grave. But it's a magnificent picture, but it is curiously out of the traditional view of Christ. And in the same way, there are these terrific, muscular, powerful figures of Christ in many of the paintings of Rubens. And it was when he'd seen some of these paintings that William Blake made the little rhyme which says, "I always thought Christ was a carpenter and not a brewer's servant, my good sir." And this precisely is the kind of reaction that we get from these departures from the traditional norm of the image, of the Christ image, as this person with a very considerable degree of ectomorphy. And we should remark here that no artist whatever has represented Christ with a high degree of endomorphy. And in this, Christianity differs very much from Confucianism. We see, for example, in some of the Chinese sacred figures are typical endomorph figures, big, soft, comfortable figures. And actually, the Confucian system is essentially an endomorphic system. It's a system of relaxation, of great preoccupation with the family, of ceremoniousness. And it is not at all like the Christian system in this respect, that it has a different kind of temperamental background to it. Well, I've given these examples as showing that there has been always this intuitive feeling about the relationship between the psyche and the physique. Well, this has gone on from the beginning of time. I mean, ever since man became conscious of the problem of his own nature, he has been preoccupied with this. And as I say, it is to me most extraordinary that the main schools of psychiatry today are indifferent to it, and also very extraordinary that we find the same sort of indifference, as far as I can see, even in behaviorism, where there is the minimum of reference to the hereditary differences between people based on their congenital physical differences. We find, for example, in Skinner's Science of Human Behavior, a very fully developed science of human behavior, which is exactly like, say, science of the laws of motion. But there is a science of human behavior, and there are laws of motion. But the laws of motion are illustrated in very different ways in a breaking wave, a flying arrow, and a butterfly. They all illustrate the laws of motion, but they illustrate them in very different ways. And it seems to me self-evident that the laws of behavior are illustrated in very different ways according to the physique and temperament of the person who illustrates them. And here again, we find an extraordinary absence of an interest in these fundamental physico-temperamental differences between people. It seems to me that a completely realistic psychology must be a constitutional psychology. It must be based upon constitution. As it is, most contemporary psychology is based on an idea of a complete environmental determinism. Well, of course the environment is immensely important, but so equally important, quite clearly, is the hereditary makeup, which is expressed in the most obvious way in the differences of physique, which are quite clearly correlated with differences of temperament, and that any adequate psychology must take into account these hereditary factors, the hereditary determinants as well as the environmental determinants. And we see this again in Freud's interpretation of mental diseases, which he puts down entirely to traumatic experiences in childhood. But I mean, the question arises is, why isn't everybody mad? Because everybody has had very traumatic experiences in childhood, but some people remain relatively sane. And this again seems to be largely a question of the physique and temperament with which people are born. Some people have a much higher degree of resistance to traumatic events in childhood than others do. And here again, Sheldon has done a very valuable work. On the basis of standardized photographs of 3,000 schizophrenics in various mental hospitals, he has come to some very interesting conclusions. He finds, first of all, that Kretschmer's earlier insight that schizophrenia was very largely correlated with a high degree of ectomorphy is true, that these 3,000 cases illustrate this very clearly. But he goes on to say that what Kretschmer did not make clear is that in a very large proportion of these cases, there was not merely ectomorphy, but there was a high degree of dysplasia, that there was this disharmony within the body, which was clearly reflected by a disharmony within the temperament. And that consequently, one has then to envisage the idea that schizophrenia is undoubtedly may be precipitated by traumatic experiences, but these are traumatic experiences which are felt to be traumatic because they occur to people in this high ectomorphic region with a high degree of dysplasia, that there wouldn't have been such disastrous effects if these people had been shaped differently. And here again we see the enormous sociological importance of this, that if this is the case, if there are people who are, so to speak, predestined to go towards schizophrenia, then there is quite a lot we can do, clearly, in the way of prevention by means of differential education, of shielding people from disturbing shocks. And there's probably also something which can be done on the pharmacological level, because it seems to be pretty clear too that most schizophrenics have some biochemical anomaly. This is coming out more and more clearly in the research which is going on now. And presumably what happens is that the traumatic experience accentuates the biochemical anomaly, which in its turn makes people schizophrenic mentally, which in turn makes them more subject to these traumatic experiences, and so we get this vicious circle being set up. And it seems very much on the cards that within the next 20 or 30 years we shall find an adequate pharmacological treatment for schizophrenia, which combined with proper psychotherapy will help to check this most serious of all the scourges which now affect civilized man, that more than 50% of all hospital beds in this country are occupied by schizophrenics. And this is our major health problem at the moment, which is simply not being solved in terms of the kind of psychotherapy which is at present available, largely because this psychotherapy has ignored the physical correlates of the disease. Now, we see then that on the deepest level, our unconscious equals our constitution, that we are determined by what we physically and temperamentally are. That naturally the environment plays a very great part, but the environment plays the particular part it does because we are the particular people that we are. And that this is, I would say, the first stage of the unconscious, the problem of the unconscious. In future lectures, I shall talk about the unconscious on a more strictly psychological level, both on its negative side, on what it does to upset and disturb us, and on its positive side, in regard to what it does to help us to be creative. But today, I think it was important to bring out this deepest physical level of the unconscious, because it is quite pointless to talk about the unconscious unless we see it rooted in these constitutional differences which make us the individuals we are. Thank you.